Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. Well, it's the virtual me here again tonight because the other one's off doing Winter's Tale again, this time in front of a bunch of girl guides, I'm told, and it will include supper and all that kind of stuff. And alas, I'm at the mercy of somebody else for a lift, so I'm probably not even going to make it into the chat box before the end of the show. So here's the digital me talking to you. And we kicked off there. First tune was a band called Flutatious, who were at the Harlequin Fair, really kicking on stage. And that was called Drunken Drummer. And they were followed by another Mobius Loop track. We had a couple of theirs last week and heard from Katie and Alex on their project. And that tune was called Living in the Milky Way. The more I listen to that little 8-track CD, the more enchanted I am by the way these guys use words and the way they use their own voices as well, because they can all sing. And those tunes are really growing on me. Some of them I really liked when I first heard them, and they're still growing. Really, really great words, well worth listening to. And I'll probably be playing all three tunes again over the next 2 or 3 weeks, because I think they're well worth a second listen. Of course, if you go to Spreaker.com and find Raconteurs News, you can actually find all of these shows with all the music still in. So all the chat and all the music, so that might be worth seeking out. I'm now putting links on my own podcast page to those, so that people who want to hear just the speech can listen to the Dr. Rock downloads, and those who want to listen to the whole thing can now enjoy the full multicoloured glorious experience. The last track we played there before I started chatting away was Horace X, and it was the Strategy remix of Skin, which appeared, I think, on one of their really early EPs. I think it was on Fish Don't Bark, and that was another really good version of the same song. So, after a weekend spent in the Pentos talk space listening to some really inspiring speakers, the working title for this week's show from the word go has been, of course, there's a fecking conspiracy, are you blind? Before I get into that, I've moved outside today because it's reasonably sunny and there's a very noisy fridge where I'm staying, so at the moment I'm sitting in the Willow Theatre, so you're hearing what an audience hears when a performance is going on, and hopefully we'll get to hear some kites mewling maybe and sheep barring and all that kind of stuff. So if you can hear background noise, that's what it is. Anyway, back to where we were last weekend and the Pentos Films talk space at the Harlequin Fair. This particular one, me and Synchro went along, and we're performers at this, which is different from being crew. Obviously, you're still a bit crew if things need attending to, but by and large, all we had to do was, you know, a couple of slots. And for that, we got into the festival, and it gave me a lot more time to go and watch bands and listen to music and drink beer, of course. And actually, I did spend most of my time in the Pentos talk space when it was active. That's really where I was, as tends to be the way of things for me. Because it's really grand to be listening to people who've done the work for you, if you like. We should be really grateful to these people, I think, all these guys that I've chatted to on the radio show over the years. But people who are doing these presentations, it can save us an awful lot of work. The other thing is that it means that you can cut straight to the core of a given subject. Say if you're listening to a Pippa King talking about the surveillance state, for example, you can find out by listening to Pippa what sort of websites she thinks are valuable to go to, where it, what you can do, where you can go to help, all that kind of stuff. And it can save an awful lot of time of wading through the gunk that's otherwise available on the internet. And because these speakers are all carefully selected, of course, you get 3 or 4 a day. It means that over the 3 days of the festival, you can see a dozen really cracking talks. It's obviously saving an awful lot of time and a gives me really interesting people to chat to as well. One of the things that's striking me about all of this year is that people really genuinely are much more receptive to these ideas. At the Harlequin Fair and Fire in the Mountain, there were many people to whom all of this was pretty much news, all of the stuff we talk about here. And A, they're interested enough to come along and listen, and B, they're taking it on board and getting in touch after the fairs and things like that. For the first time in, like, 6 years or so, I really feel that the people around me are starting to resonate with the things that we've been talking about for a long, long time now. And hopefully, thus, more people are going to be interested to investigate it, is what's going on, because we all know what happens when you start to investigate it. Far from turning out to be just an ugly rumour, it all turns out to be a whole lot more true than we might even have first imagined, really. And, of course, perhaps as a result of further investigation, more people will choose to act, which is ultimately where we need to be heading, I think. If the more people change their behaviour, the more the behaviour of others is going to change. And so I think it's a hugely worthwhile activity, both bringing people to the point where they can see that they've been lied to. There is definitely a conspiracy, there's absolutely no doubt, and if you can't see it, it's only because you're not looking. But even though many more people know that something's wrong, and perhaps even to some extent know the nature of the problem, most of them, it appears to me, still feel powerless. In other words, it kind of feel like it's got nothing to do with them, which is sort of right, until you know what's going on. And that's the point, of course, is that we're not powerless. Or rather, if we are powerless, it's only because we're giving it away to somebody else. As Christopher Diogi said, if we're not taking charge, then somebody's taking charge off us. There is no middle ground. It seems to be either the one thing or the other. And that's why this is really important. Powerless. See, that's good, isn't it? Darren, I'd love that, Christopher. Powerless, because somebody's taking charge off us. So, like I say, keeping up the info, keeping up, because there's so many people out there who are still completely unaware that there's anything even slightly awry about what they've been taught and what they're being told on a daily basis. So keeping up the info is really necessary, and it needs to be mixed in, of course, with a fair smattering of the kind of responses that we as individuals can have. Because if we're going to start laying this stuff on people's plate, I think it's probably best to give them some cutlery to deal with it. So, and I think the Pentos Talkspace this year had a really great lineup for filling just this kind of brief. Did a really good job. We kicked off on the Friday with just one talk, Mark Devlin. And his talk was called Free Will, Consciousness, Consent, and the Corporate Music Industry. A brief look at Dr. Rock's podcast page will reveal one or two other interviews on this subject. And the names of the people who helped me out there, I can't quite remember, but I know saw them at one of the Truth Juice gatherings. And it really is absolutely endemic. There's massive connections between basically the rock industry or the pop industry or whatever we call it in all of its forms, and military intelligence. And this has been documented and verified by now a whole string of researchers and is widely available. Most of the most famous people we can think of from the 60s were actually the children of military intelligence officers or military officers of one sort or another. Many movies that we think maybe are independent have actually been directed by the CIA. So this thing extends to actors, entertainers generally, in fact. And it does boil down once again to consent. Consent is the key. It's in his title, Consent and the Corporate Music Industry. And it's a subject I'm concentrating on this year, as we'll probably hear. In the music industry, it would appear, in the entertainment industry generally, consent of individuals is being suborned by trauma-based mind control. And this was a very, very reluctant study of mine. It was something that I only really looked into when I was 3 years into my tumble down the rabbit hole, and the reason I looked into it was because it was just persistently crossing my desk. It, like everything else, it's all so tied in with each other that trauma-based mind control kept coming up. And it's all to do with the sectioning off of a part of a young mind by basically subjecting it to large amounts of trauma, and that bit that's been sectioned off can then be controlled. It all sounds completely bizarre, but, I mean, again, this is one of those things that just a little bit of surface study will very, very quickly reveal that there is something going on that's worthy of further investigation. Many of these people died young as well. Many apparently at the age of 27. Mark Devlin's got a book out there which I meant to get off him, but he scuttled off. He had to go the same night as he was talking, because I'd really like to see some of the detail on this stuff. But it's something I've noticed myself. We've heard that they tend to die on fortuitous dates, a lot of these people. And is all of this by coincidence or design, we ask ourselves? And if it's by design, who's doing it and why? And one of the main things that Mark covered was the business of Paul McCartney and whether or not at some point, really relatively early in the Beatles' career, he was replaced by another Paul, the one that we've got nowadays. And as it happens, Nick Collerstrom, who was with us talking about 9/11 and Star Wars and was on the show, I think a couple of shows ago now, we talked about the Paul McCartney thing, and I've been sort of vaguely interested in that. I heard a lot of stuff about the album covers, but it didn't, and as I said to Nick, in my opinion, it's really quite clear that there are two different people involved when you listen to the one competencies of the one and the competencies of the other. But Nick's written a book, Nick Collerstrom's written a book called Life and Death of Paul McCartney. And I haven't got the dates down, but basically it's from, well, obviously when he was born, basically through till 1966. And he covers all the cover hints on the albums and stuff. Apparently the head and face are forensically different. You know, they've been measured photographs and looked at the teeth and things like that. One of them is the new one, several inches taller than the old one, which can be seen quite clearly when you've got photographs of one standing next to a given individual and then the other one standing next to the same individual. Something which apparently it was the world management team worked very hard to avoid that, to avoid that from happening, basically, and they did that by stopping performing entirely as a live band in 1966. I never knew they did that. So instead of actually sharing microphones as a band, it was arranged that they weren't going to be seen together, because this would have made it really obvious. They got different ears from each other. Ears are apparently really distinctive, and in some countries in the world, they use ears. Germany, I think it was, an ear is like a fingerprint. And there's basic types of ear where the ear is attached to the side of the head and all that sort of stuff. And the two Paul's ears are completely different from each other, such that the new Paul apparently had to wear false ears for a while. Then there's this pre-information thing. Part of this whole gig, part of the whole plan, organisation, is that one way or the other, the things that are being worked upon us to our disadvantage, it is important for the people who are doing the working to inform us of what they're doing beforehand. And Nick Collerstrom was given a book called The Memoir of Billy Shears, which I discover from reading his book is very expensive. Even the Kindle version is $33 or so. And so he was pretty pleased to be given a copy, and he set about it. And I think, oh, well, for sure, he says this is what actually set him off on writing his own book on the subject. Because the memoir of Billy Shears appears to have been written by the new Paul. And it was written on the understanding that there would be a solid line of fiction running through it, that it couldn't be made to look exactly like fact. This was a thing that was going on when people were writing the Illuminati books and stuff like that. A careful blend of fact and fiction can make it very, very difficult, make it a lot more difficult to tell what is actually real and what's not, because you can never quite know where your own knowledge of fact stops. So say somebody's talking to you about the death of John Dillinger, which we've probably all heard about, like they did in the Illuminati, and then you carry the story on until there's fictional bits. Probably none of us know enough about it to know where one story finishes and the other story starts. And this was the idea with Billy Shears. I think nowadays they actually call it plausible deniability. You tell the story in such a way that it can't actually be pinned on you. And that is fundamentally, I think, what's going on here. And so we can see the same kind of control operation as we're getting used to seeing all over the place. Also, I think Billy Shears is a really interesting name, isn't it, given all of the debate about William Shakespeare not perhaps being who we think he is. So, as I said, the world management team feel that they must inform us in order to give us choice. Something which, as we're going to find out, is totally key to the whole game. And what Mark Devlin pointed out, I really do recommend reading Nick's book. It's completely great. But what Mark's pointing out is that our subconscious is being told the truth through fiction, films, music, videos, and things like this Billy Shears book, whereas our conscious mind is being lied to through news, documentaries, and syndicated media disinformation. There's lots of things in the Paul McCartney story that I found really... In fact, because... knew a little bit about this and a little bit about that, almost every single page was making me think of a lot more stuff than was just on the page. There are several key public publications, basically, and events during the Paul story, which obviously goes on from 1966 really to the present day, I guess. And a lot of these events, major things, occur on September the 11th. It does seem to be an important date, and we might write it off as a coincidence, but A, there's quite a few of them. And B, understanding statistics and stuff, if we look at generally all of the things that seem to be tied in with that particular date, just that research in itself is going to reveal quite a lot of stuff which is unlikely to have, very unlikely to have happened just by chance on that date. There appears to be an element of orchestration. Many potentially inconvenient people die in the Paul McCartney story as well, something that I hadn't actually realised. It's pretty gory and sorry tale, really. It really casts a totally new light on the lyrics as well, on everything they did after 1966. Nick goes into lots and lots of their songs, and actually songs written and performed by other people about the Beatles, because obviously... lots and lots of people must have known this was going on. Lots and lots of people knew Paul McCartney by 1966. Apparently, they were at that point, this is another really strange thing, at that point, according to this book, the Beatles were outselling all other bands combined planet-wide. And when I read that, I thought, well, my goodness, that's unlikely to have happened without a little bit of support and a little bit of help from somewhere. It's sure as hell never happened to anybody else or anything like it. It would appear as well that John and George were both really quite frightened men. George especially apparently spent a lot of time making sure that his home was really, really secure. And both, of course, were unfortunately attacked by, apparently lunatics. And it's made quite clear that George did effectively live in a mighty secure place. It was described as a fortress. And despite that, he ended up being stabbed 44 times in his own home. And unfortunately for George, his lunatic got past all the fences and gates and alarms and locked doors. And he managed to do it without tripping a single alarm. It's amazing what a bit of madness can do for you, isn't it? And if it hadn't been for George's wife with a poker... laying the guy out, that would have been the end of George. And then the bloke apparently gets off with an insane plea, gets put away for a little while, and 19 months later is released. And George Harrison, of course, died a couple of months later of cancer. So he got out after 19 months, after breaking into a more or less impregnable place, stabbing a bloke 44 times. Gonna make you wonder, hasn't it? So it's a ripper book. It really is totally fascinating, and it's really pacey and well told as well. It's got lots and lots of stuff that we're familiar with because it's a familiar story. So things that we can hang the information we're getting off, if you like. It's not a completely unploughed field, I'm sure, the Beatles, as far as any of us are concerned. But I think Nick does a really, really brilliant job at increasing the pace all the way through the book. You kind of feel like you're going up through the gearbox, and it's really not until the end that you're really running at full speed. So even though I was really impressed by everything I was reading and intrigued by it, I just got more and more excited as the book went on. Well worth the cash. So big thanks to Nick for that, to Nick Collerstrom for that, and for all the effort he put into that. Like I say, saves the rest of us a whole lot of time, because we have our own work to do, do we not? One thing I would say, though, is that probably the proofreader should be shot because there are more typos in it than there are in 12 months supply of The Guardian. My little red pencil was extremely busy, Nick. And another thing it made me think of, you see, the thing is, when you look at it, and all the stuff you think, it just can't be an accident. It can't be people reacting to the fact that somebody accidentally killed themselves in a car crash or whatever. And indeed, there's quite a lot of stuff, especially coming from the new Paul, suggesting, and to a certain extent from the old Paul as well, when you think about when he wrote yesterday, that there was cooperation, a transfiguration, some sort of magical background to the whole sorry tale. And I heard a long, long time ago that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were simply a creation of the Tavistock Institute. And one of the things that really kept coming up whilst I was reading Nick's book, although he carefully avoids such things because he wants to look at the evidence, I think, and keep it straight. What comes to my mind all the way through is trauma-based mind control. We know it's going on in the pop industry. We know it's going on in the movie industry. And a lot of what goes on in this particular story reminds me of what I've read about trauma-based mind control and the videos I've seen. It's certainly, at the very least, definitely leaves the impression of a vast and well-resourced plot. And that's a difficult kind of impression to leave unless there is a vast and well-resourced plot, seems to me. Fascinating, really. Story just gets bigger and bigger. Nick himself, as we heard the other week, talked of 9/11 and a fictional representation of key ideas behind 9/11 as presented in the first three Star Wars movies. That's the first three Star Wars movies that were filmed after the second three, which had been filmed beforehand. And again, I don't think we can talk about the great going away of buildings too often, because it's still pretty amazing, but many people believe the utterly, utterly impossible, completely incredible, and massively, terminally undermined official story. And as long as that's the case, it's worth talking about it. And because it's so huge, and because so many things happened that were utterly, utterly impossible, there's plenty of room for lots of people to be speaking about it, and you always find something new. Nick Colostrom had some great pictures of the stills of those two big towers going down. He also said that on that day, seven buildings went down, all belonging to one individual. And I didn't know that, so that's something I've got to look into. So it's like, that's why it's still worth talking about, is because it's so massive, there's always new stuff to learn. Fundamentally, though, you don't need to learn anything about that, do you? All you have to do is watch the buildings going down, and you know that it can't be what you say it is, surely. Especially when a building sort of 64 stories high goes down without actually being hit by anything, and as a result, apparently, of office fires. So loads of people still believe that story, so it's still worth talking about. And they believe that just like many believe that, the same Paul McCartney wrote and performed yesterday as the one who performed and wrote, say, Mull of Kintyre, or indeed, who's that knocking on the door, do me a favour and let them in. You don't have to look at either of them very hard, I suspect. But I'll definitely take Nick's Phantom Menace proposition from those Star Wars movies, and I didn't go and watch them, but I probably will. I probably will borrow them and give them a look now. And this, again, is part of the thing that where there's a bit of pre-programming. The information is apparently put out again and again. This was another thing that came out in Mick Devlin's talk when he looked at how many albums and various covers and bits of artwork prefigured what happened on the great going away of buildings. Apparently there's hundreds of them, and once again, I've seen now two or three interviews with and talks by people who've been able to show different examples. So it's absolutely huge. And the idea that the Star Wars movies were designed on the movie screen to reflect what was going on out in the real world at that time with the great going away of buildings is not completely incredible at all. At all. In fact, it's very, very credible. And what's more, it engages certain parts of our, the old idea can engage certain parts of our imagination and attention as part of any general project to distract us from what is truly going on. So, it would clear, just be clear, it really is clear, isn't it, that not only, even on these terms, even on this little bit of stuff, that there most definitely is conspiracy everywhere we look. And we appear to be being repeatedly shown that there's a conspiracy everywhere we look. And yet, it's not just other people who aren't aware of conspiracies. I keep finding new stuff that makes me think, oh my goodness, will you look at that? So the actual depth and scope of the thing will remain a surprise, I suspect, until the day we go into the ground. Or, of course, until we start putting things right. Well, now we're going to have a bit of a break from the virtual doctor's tirade on conspiracy theory and listen to a recording I got, which is a little bit of interview and three songs by a young lass called Keris, who I met at the Harlequin Fair. And the first, she plays the guitar and sings. She's got one of her own songs, but she mostly plays other people's. And when I first saw her, she was playing in the bar. And as I mentioned earlier, everything's quite close to everything else in the Harlequin. And the bar's kind of on a focal centre between the kind of circus tent, the Nomad stage, and the Harlequin stage. And so it picks up a lot of noise. And she was playing there with an acoustic guitar and a plugged-in acoustic guitar and a mic. And she was she was blinding, even with all that background noise, although you couldn't really hear it. You couldn't really hear the noise. And she got to play a couple of times more, I think, during the festival. She's a really keen little performer, works really hard at it. And again, we tried to record those on the voice recorder, but there was too much background noise. So in the end, her dad, Tom, I think, and her little sister, Indra, and she came to the doctor's little recording studio, and we put the voice recorder going, had a chat with Keris, and listened to two or three of her songs. The first two are cover versions, and the last one is the one she wrote herself. And we have a little bit of an interview in between the songs. So it's three songs. It's about 10 or 15 minutes or so. She was persistently apologetic about the fact that the songs were so sad. But I think if anything's sad about it, it's that a 15-year-old should really feel the need to pick these songs. I think her selection of songs is really impressive itself. And I'll leave, really, her to do herself justice, although I must say that you'll be hearing this on 128 kilobytes a second stream, and it was recorded on a voice recorder in MP3 format. So although the sound is, you know, as good as it normally is, it doesn't anything like actually capture the magic of hearing this young lady sing. So this is Keris for the next 10 or 15 minutes or so, a little bit of interview, a little bit of music, and then I'll be back with you. And this is, of course, the virtual Dr. Rock on Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, recording himself live in the Willow Theatre, because he's away doing theatre. Here's Keris. There you go. That was Keris. I didn't get her proper full stage moniker, if she has one. But hopefully we'll be staying in touch with her. It'd be nice to get a proper recording of her at some point and hear what she does in future as well, because she's very keen. And as I said in the chat with her, it's amazing to hear one so young delivering songs with such experience. I really do wonder sometimes what it is that's manifesting in our young people, and it gives me great cause for hope, I must admit. And it also gives me cause to carry on doing what I'm doing, because I think they're the ones we're working for. And I'd love to hear her singing a merry song as well. So I was there as well, obviously, to do the usual chatting to people, and I did my this year's Are We Governed by Consent routine, some of which you'll have heard on a show probably two or three weeks ago now. So I introduced it by showing them asking them if they thought we were governed by consent, and none of them did. And I showed them Theresa May saying that we are, and then showed them the Mark Stevens and the or talk to them, because the bloody vids weren't working, the tech was a bit weird again. So talk to them about the Mark Stevens interview, in which a law professor admits that there's no rational proof of the applicability of laws to men and women. And Simon Spaniard's talk about legal jurisdiction and the fact that person in the legal realm can, under some circumstances, mean penis. I talked to them a little bit, as I did with you, about the Meet Your Straw Man video, and introduced them to the idea of the small, thinking, flesh and blood eye with a dot on top of it, and the corporatized, unthinking, compliant, and very, very lucrative capitalized eye without the dot on top of it. And this, there was a lot, there were a fair few people in the tent for this one, and again, afterwards, I got the impression that it was complete news to some people, especially to a lot of young people in the crew there, so it was very, very exciting to be bringing this stuff in front of people for the first time, and it appeared to be cogent enough to be worthy for them of further investigation, and I've heard from one or two of them since the shows. The thing is that if you've never heard of this, you have most definitely been lied to. Only, as I always say, a cursory investigation of just that little bit of stuff I've just said will reveal to you certain things about what you are rather than who you are. And if you've been lied to, so is everybody else. Cock up, think of your conspiracy. Do you think it's an accident that none of this stuff has come to the fore unless you choose to go and dig your way into the rabbit hole and find it out? It's basic. It's basic. The people we're listening to are either patsies or frauds. The ones that are habitually teaching us either do know what's going on and aren't telling us, in which case they're frauds, or they don't know what's going on, in which case they're patsies and are taking the money. For thoroughly justified reasons, I can quite understand why this occurs. And that is how the conspiracy hides itself, because there's a bunch of people who are extremely willing and complicit and possibly don't know what's going on, and that can make the whole thing look very, very real. And after I'd done all of that stuff, I do some stuff which I didn't actually do in the show, because you've heard it all before, but the summary is great. It's pretty much a tornado of stuff. And I'm planning on taking all of this into pubs and public arenas very shortly and see what happens with it. But you kick off by pointing out that, remember, these people don't think we're consenting. They don't think we're governed by consent. So understand, apply, submit, plea or plead, the list is endless. They all mean consent. They all mean submit, hand over. Income tax must be a matter of consent, because there's no law telling us that we've got to pay it. Not even the straw party apparently has a law saying that it has to pay the income tax, so that must be consent. If we're not being absolutely forced to do it with a gun to our head. Private parking fines, as was shown on that famous watchdog video, private parking fines. Apparently there's no obligation to pay them. I know they believe that they've changed the rules on this, but I don't believe they can. So fundamentally, that again is a matter of consent. Hundreds of thousands of these things are paid out every year on the evidence of a camera. And apparently, according to Watchdog, a solicitor I think he was on there, there is no obligation. So that must be consent as well. If we accept an offer of contract, that's consent, is it not? And if, as I believe is the case, everything that we're encountering in the outside world, outside you and me, and possibly even that, is an offer of contract, everything is a matter of contract, then we must be consenting all the time, not none of the time. All title is illusory, that's a good one. Mr., Mrs., Miss, and including you. If we accept title, we consent. If we protest on the streets, we consent, because we give the impression that we think somebody else needs to do something about it, and that is consent to them to do just that. Registration, handing over rights of guardianship, that's consent. Voting, as I said, that's consent. Talking to a policy enforcement officer generally is consent, and the policy enforcement officer is, of course, paid to seek and obtain this consent, what is more. Even silence can be deemed to be acquiescence, so even silence can be consent. So, given that most people do not believe that we are governed by consent on the evidence of asking for a show of hands at these things, and I'll obviously get more shows of hands hopefully as time goes round, but by and large it's very few people in any given crowd that believe we do consent to what is happening to us. And that means that nobody was told it at school, I think. Don't bother asking them that. So what do you think? If all of this is right, and once again you go looking at this, you will find that all of that is very, very simple to hunt down, as I'm sure everybody on Raconteurs News will confirm. And given that, what do you think? Cock-up or conspiracy? All some horrible accident? Do you even think it's an accident? It's a good question to ask yourself. Is whether you believe things are cock-up or a conspiracy, because I'm sure this idea that it's all just some horrible mistake and that sooner or later we're going to sort it out is deep in all of us. I know that I still find it in myself whilst I'm doing this work. And, of course, it's important if you're going to do this to people and say, well, here you go, this is what it's really like. It's important to perhaps, like I say, if you're going to put all this on their plate, give them some cutlery to deal with it. So, learning to ask questions, learning to make no claims, thinking about who we choose to talk to, because we're not actually obliged to talk to anybody, thinking about sometimes keeping the door closed, thinking about sometimes not answering the phone, thinking about doing things in writing rather than over the phone, thinking about returning that letter to sender, thinking about just saying it's private. Once we realise how these manipulations work, it is not impossible to do things about some of them. And the more people that do things about some of them, the more it's going to be possible to do things to deal with the bigger problems. And one of the things I'd really like is if all of the people who get to hear this talk recognise enough of what's being said to try just being non-compliant once. Just see if they don't like it. See if they like it, not being non-compliant. Just try something easy and safe. There's plenty of it out there. I mean, given that all of this stuff's being visited from every single direction, it's fairly easy to pick a soft target. It's like Cookie said, why not try stopping watching the television just for 7 days? Just give yourself a bit of time to rid yourself of what I'm pretty sure is a physiological addiction. Give yourself 7 days clear, and then perhaps if you really feel the drive, which I don't believe you will, go and give it a look again and see if it looks any different. These little changes can change the way our minds work, change our conscious view of the world, and that will inevitably change the way we act and react. So it's a ripping talk. But consent can be and is granted by behaviour. We are governed by consent, and we consent by our behaviour, by what we do and what we choose not to do, I guess. If we behave as if all of this nonsense applies to us, if we behave as if all of this stuff applies to us, then it does. And that is consent. Shocking. Isn't it? Really, when you boil it down to the actual point. And Christy Ogie, I really enjoyed his talks as well. I don't want to go too much into them because I'm hoping to, well, I'm pretty sure he'll come on the show and we'll be able to get into them, because his talk was completely different from mine on consent. But at the same time, it covered all the topics from a completely different angle. And I was sitting at the back of the tent, throwing him the O's and clapping, and he was just great. So, but he was talking along similar lines. He was talking of the importance of sound, about how we compose ourselves, about how our body contains organs, and loads and loads and loads of examples about how our vocabulary about ourselves is based in the acoustic or resonant world. The point is that we are sound, we are resonance, and, you know, as is the cosmos of which we are a part of it, we are not a part from it, and it's all sound. So Sound changes things because things are sound. By changing what we say and how we say it, we do change the world around us. And I begin to suspect, given the 9/11, the great going away of buildings stuff and the fake Paul McCartney stuff, that it's possible that our conscious reality is much, much more plastic than we believe it to be. Look at what these people have managed to pull off. Putting something well in the public eye and keep it secret. How weird is that, eh? And one of the things I went to, which I haven't had time to talk about really recently, is I was at an international sharing Shakespeare week, which is perhaps something we'll get onto. But one of the things that was in it was a presentation by a bunch of young people about abusive relationships, something there is plenty of in Shakespeare, it has to be said. And in their little play, they gave out a little government leaflet at the end of it, but in their play they were talking about, they were trying to demonstrate abusive relationships and how sly and underhand they can be, and they can kind of worm their way into people's lives without them realising that they're there. And in the little cartoon booklet they handed out, which is a subject which, folks, I am most definitely going to be returning to, because when I think of abusive relationships, I think of government, and this booklet reads totally differently when you read it that way. It's a bloody shame that these 26 sorts of abusive behaviour in relationships need to be put on a stage to be recognised. It's a great shame that it's not just being sorted out, you know, at base, because it seems to me that the fact that that is the case, the fact that it does need to be talked about and dramatically presented and put into little cartoon booklets with nice little bullet points and all that kind of stuff, is because there is a massive failure of communication, you know, because we're being lied to all the time. It's extremely difficult for anybody to deal honestly with anybody else because we haven't got honest information on which to make decisions, and that fundamentally undermines everybody's game. It's an undermining of community, it's an undermining of communication, because the world we're living in is not the world it appears to be. It should be natural for us to deal with these things in a functional society. In fact, I'd say the fact that we've managed to develop 26 identifiable forms of abusive relationships is itself a sign of the dysfunction that we're experiencing. It really doesn't need to be like this. The other thing all of this relies on, this abuse in relationships, is an inability, in my terms, if you like, to withdraw consent, or to make sure that what actually goes on is something that we've consented to. And in Christopher's terms, I think it's an inability to recognise that a line needs to be drawn. Really beautiful phrase of his, I think, and one of the things that he examines quite in some detail in his talks, is the drawing of a line, which is, of course, what we're all failing to do by failing to realise that we're actually consenting to all of the mayhem that's being committed around us. And the line needs to be drawn. Perhaps this little play showed us in domestic relationships as well as in relationships with wider authority. It's a failure of boundaries. And Chris encourages, basically, most excitingly, I think, a return to what he calls the indigenous mind, to an awareness that we are manifestations of and manifestations within a resonant whole. We're not separate from it, we're part of it, and we make a difference to it by being in it. I like to say, I was with Darren all the way. Many times he reminded me of my own processes and conclusions through what he was saying. And I've been watching, we've been working together on and off for 7 years or so. But I feel that some ducks that were still eggs last time I saw him are now standing in a neat little row and all quacking quite happily. Like I say, he'll be joining us in the not-too-distant future, I hope, providing we can get a bit of mutual time together. So if we're talking about lines being drawn and all this nonsense, I think that the most helpful line to be drawn has got to be between the private realm and the public realm. And I like Simon Spaniard's definition of the private and public, because it's a complex area, isn't it? And that is, if you can see it, it's public, and if you can't see it, it's private. And, of course, it's in quite a lot of cases our decision whether people see things or not. So this is the line, I think, that's really, really becoming blurred by this unending cycle of offer of contract and acceptance, which forms consent. That is what's leading to the blurring of the line between the private and the public. In fact, the blurring of the line between the private and the public is one of the basic causes of the problem, because basically, you know, men and women who think they're doing this sort of stuff are acting as corporations. And so that's your public and private all kind of meshed together. No lines have been drawn, no boundaries exist. Look at what's happening to banking. I know they've completely divorced all retail banking monies from investment banking monies, which means that anything you give them is as at much risk as the most risky stuff that people are giving them. Public and private, well mixed up. We can start drawing those little lines right now. And I guess, I suppose it would appear one of the things that these things sort of a weekend in such a place kind of, because you're listening to so many different things that are related but separate, some of the shadows start getting sharper. We start getting a better image of the kind of silhouette we're looking, as it were, as we shine the light on the subject. And it would seem to me after this weekend, it would appear that because our subconscious is being informed by the movies and the video games and all the rest of the stuff, and because we readily give our consent, albeit under threat of coercion and use of force and without full manifestation of what's going on, the world management team seems to have deduced from this that it's safe to presume that what's happening is informed consent. Because we are being informed, and we are consenting. They love it, these plays with words. And so the world management team, basically it goes its own merry way with, bizarrely, with an authority and impunity that is freely granted by men and women, apparently, by incarnate souls, who are some of the most influential, you know, entities about. Change the world, create things. Endlessly resourceful, you know. And that's where all of the endless resource is going currently. It's kind of overview that I got of the weekend was great. You know, the great going away of buildings, the fake Paul McCartney, the nature of spells, words and magic. The fact that in a patriarchy, all of the men don't have any influence at all are collared, cuffed and tied. In a patriarchy, all the men are dressed as slaves. Endless connections between pop culture, be it, as I say, music, movies, videos, software, probably even operating systems, I would imagine, wouldn't you? Loads of connections between all of that and military intelligence, and that's one of the subjects that once you just kind of keep half an eye on it, just keeps developing. It doesn't get any smaller. More and more connections are formed as time goes by, and more people look at it. We men and women are being required to submit fingerprints and palm prints to access food and information. This is fundamentally shocking, but doesn't seem, actually, on experimenting with one or two people I've met since listening to Pippa's latest talk, doesn't seem to be particularly shocking to some people who are actually quite happy to have their children chipped so that they know where they are. And if they're not willing to give up their biometric data, apparently they're being made to eat their food outside. And the information that they are surrendering apparently is finding its way onto what passes for a permanent record nowadays, which is much more permanent and much more of a record than it was when I was at school and in education. And it is possible, and I would guess it would become, if it's possible now, it will become more frequent, because that's the way it works. It is possible that policy enforcement officers will have access to all of this school data, should they so need it. And there's probably some doubt as to whether they'd ever remove it as well. fingerprints, retina scans, palm prints, facial recognition software, gaits, the way you walk, what Pepper, I think, called cognitive biometrics. All of those can be applied right the way, not at the moment, thanks to the actions of Pippa and people like her in primary schools, but they're definitely fully involved in secondary schools. And it's all, do you see, to do with compliance and consent. We haven't heard of many people actually resisting having their children chipped and recorded in this way, and that's because quite a lot of people don't seem to think it matters, and it would still seem that quite a lot of people are completely oblivious to the fact that it's happening. So Pippa King, 10 out of 10 to you, Pippa. It was lovely to see you again. She, you know, a real demonstration of how much difference one individual can make, attracting, like as we do through our intent and our action, sort of like minds to our cause. Whole lot of stuff that Pippa was attracted to look into because she'd seen a picture of a fingerprint scanner and thought, well, that's not possible, and then saw one in the school of her own children. That little synchronicity sent her on the whole path. Just like, Dr. Nick Collerstrom getting that copy of the Billy Shears book sent him on the Paul McCartney path. And all of this makes a huge difference to the people that come after you, just as the people who came before us are making a big difference to us. So John also put the cap on it, I think, on Sunday afternoon. John of Pentos Films, Jonathan Adams, did a talk. His talk, You Are Being Lied To, which is basically a potted history of major false flag operations. And nowadays, it has to be said, does it not, that the whole damn thing looks pretty much like a false flag event. In fact, one's pretty much forced to conclude, I think, that that's actually what it is. We also had, as we heard on one of the earlier shows, we had Adrian Gilbert and the Stone of Scone. I mean, what on earth is that all about? It's a stone, which is apparently in some sort of ratio to the biblical dimensions that were given for the Ark of the Covenant. It arrives at some point from Egypt in Ireland, where it hangs out for a while, and is subsequently moved to England, where it's put under the throne of whoever the regnant happens to be at the time, and it becomes a constitutional coronation stone. So it's obviously a religious and a constitutional and a political artifact of some sort to a certain sort of people. And then in 1997, John Major sends it to Scotland, where it is now in a museum. I mean, what is going on there? It's not simply being shunted around for no perceived benefit, is it? And was the removal of it from underneath the apparent throne of the apparent regnant something to do with surrender of authority to Brussels, such that this thing needs only be in a museum now? Who knows? And who knows whether this has all happened before? Who knows whether when King John handed the Pope to the, handed the crown, the English crown, to the Pope's representative, and then took it back? Who knows whether it was ever really his again? This is the other thing. This sort of thing doesn't just happen once. It happens over and over and over again. But I was really fascinated by that story, and of course it's a mystery. Bit like, to a certain extent, the Paul McCartney is. We sort of don't know what's going on, and still, of course, the great going away of buildings. Who knows what was actually happening there? Who was doing what? And then there's the question, of course, is it the real Stone of Scone? Is it the real Stone of Scone? And if it was nicked and replaced, like Paul McCartney, why did that happen? I'm probably going to have to read the book. Books are best for me. I think I quite like watching YouTube videos and things like that, but I find reading things on screens don't work so well, probably because of my tutelage and conditioning when I was in education, but I find books work best for me. So I'm going to have to read that, just because the facts I did manage to pick up listening to Adrian's talk and the things that I gleaned from chatting with him on the radio are absolutely fascinating. My enemy is just going, you know, WTF, as it were. What on earth is that about? There's obviously something important going on, but damned if I can glean what it is. And thanks again to Adrian, of course, for doing the work. And I got a second outing as well. And this time round I did an older talk of mine called History's Bigger Than You Think, in which I went looking for evidence of human cooperation, basically, earlier than Sumer, earlier than the apparent arrival of civilization spontaneously in southern Iraq around 3200 BC. I was intrigued by what happened there and why it happened, so I started looking back in time a bit. And I asked people at the beginning of the course how many people at school were taught about Rome, and nearly everybody's hand goes up. Bloody Romans is all we get. And you ask them whether they heard about Greece. Most of them heard about Greece as well, but probably only through the myths and legends, which is the main part of the program, of course. Ask people if they heard about Egypt in school, and that will be relatively rare. There'll be far fewer hands going up at that point. Ask them whether any of them heard about Sumer at school, and no hands go up at all. So we're not even teaching about the place where school and writing came from in school, which is surely a bit of a basic problem, I would have thought. But my search showed me that, and I showed pictures of all of this, that in 29,000 BC or 27,000 BC, there was a couple of 200 or 300 ceramics, people making ceramics in the Ice Age on the border of Austria. And they were clearly trading with other settlements, which I don't think have discovered. 17,000 BC, there was a place called Çatalhöyük, Çatalhöyük, on a Pleistocene lake in some godforsaken place where, again, several hundred people were living in quite advanced living quarters. You clearly had a society of one sort or another, though they didn't appear to have administrative or religious centres. 12,000 BC, I talk about Göbekli Tepe, which is probably the single most impressive Neolithic find anywhere on the planet, in as far as it's a really, really huge, carved, complex set of stone structures, which itself is confusing enough. 12,000 BC, of course, is 7,000 years or so before Stonehenge was started, or before solstitial marker posts appeared on the plains anyway. And then somebody came, that was mysterious enough, we don't know who built that or where they were living, because there's no sign of a settlement. And then somebody else apparently came along several thousand years ago and deliberately buried it. So none of this stuff's talked about at school. And that's to say, and I say nothing in that talk about pre-Inca structures, of weathering on the Sphinx, the technologically outrageous Giza pyramid, repeated and incontrovertible evidence of high-speed drills in ancient societies all the way from Peru to Egypt. And that, as I say, is just the start. What we've been taught as history is only a story, just like everything else. It's been authorised, it's been planned, it's been plotted, it's been pre-advertised, and then executed. And as I've been saying so frequently over recent weeks, this stuff, you don't have to look too hard to verify this. And this basic information is quite enough to make us start thinking differently about how we do things. In fact, what I like to say at the end of the talk is that whilst we're nescient, whilst we don't know what's going on, we're basically innocent, as Simon Spaniard proved when he went in and tried to turn himself in. And they said, well, did you know what you were doing at the time? And he said, no. And they said, well, off you go then. But once somebody has told you about this stuff and you choose to ignore it, that's ignorance, which is different from nescience. And in a way, whilst we don't know that there's some kind of fraud or willy-waggling going on, we're innocent. But once we know that there's a fraud, we're complicit. So I have to apologise to people for that. But like I say, my main aim is not to prove anything to anybody. All of those talks, all of those different pieces of information are clearly well informed by people who spent a long, long time thinking hard about what they're going to write down or what they're going to talk about. A tremendous amount of work, as I said at the beginning of the show, which saves the rest of us a tremendous amount. And we need to do them the favour of giving it some respect, you know, just turning away from it and saying, oh, you know, you're 30 years of research or whatever, you're clearly deluded or, you know, lacking discernment or whatever isn't good enough. Really, if everything has been authorised and planned and all that kind of stuff, I think the prime recognition is that the only truth is us. The only truth is us. As we find out when we discover each other in festivals and actually have a time to get on with people in a safe place and have the kind of fun that we should be having a lot more often. The only truth is us, eyeball to eyeball, doing what we want to do together rather than spending most of our time doing what we're coerced to do apart from each other. So I think it's time for a bit of a break. I'm going to play you some Solana now, the Triangle Key. We heard one of their tracks last week. They also were playing at the Harlequin Fair, and they also are a really cracking dancing band, which is how I came across having one of their CDs. So like I say, this is called the Triangle Key. It's off the Travelling Fair. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. I'll be back with you in 5 minutes or so. Solana there and the Triangle Key. Well, that's about the end of the festival season already. I see we're entering the fourth third of the year. And I'm probably going to try to get along to that literary festival, to the Dark Mountain Festival, because I've found that various people I know are going along to that. And I'm having read one of their books now and the manifesto. I'm really fascinated to see what sort of individuals turning up there. And I've never been to a literary festival, so we'll see what we can organise there. Apart from that, we're going to be back inside, I think, pretty soon, interviewing people. Got lots and lots of people to talk with, though, after this summer's activities. I think there's an exciting set of shows coming up, hopefully. And we will continue to go out and try and find bands and all that kind of stuff. Well, it looks like we're finding ourselves with a little bit of spare time in this show. So I think I'm going to return to the idea of abusive relationships and see whether these ideas they're putting across don't apply or maybe do apply in our relationship with government. As you remember, I said that we watched a dramatic presentation. Basically, it was a kind of workshop piece, really, which is designed to put in front of social workers and other youths and things like that so that people can talk about abuse within domestic relationships, really. And there's a little leaflet that comes with it, which is about half the size of A5. It's got a few pages in it. It's all nice and simple, as they like things nowadays. Always reminds me of cuneiform. Lots of distressed-looking little cartoons of youngsters of one sort or another. And the little booklet is entitled Relationships Shouldn't Hurt. I'm sure you can find it. Unfortunately, I can't tell you who published it or anything, because it looks like the back of it got roached. So it kicks off with, are you safe, it says. People think domestic abuse is about a man hitting a woman. It's a whole lot more than that. And point one, it says, do you see signs of domestic abuse? And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to cleverly replace the use of the words boyfriend, girlfriend, or partner with the word government. And the first question it asks you is, does government make you feel pressurised to do things that you wouldn't want to do? Interesting question, isn't it? Point two on this page says, is someone close to you in an abusive relationship? Are they being threatened physically, emotionally, controlling, sexually, or financially by a government? Is your friend becoming withdrawn, making excuses not to meet you? Do they appear to be scared of the government? Is someone close to you suffering? Are you worried about how they are being treated by their government? You can do something to help by talking to a friend, teacher, or other responsible adult. Better still, you can find somebody who knows a bit about government. On the next page, it says, unsure if you are safe, with a woe-ridden looking teenager of some sort standing just outside a housing estate on some green hills with a couple of cartoon flowers. Please answer the statements on the following pages with either yes or no. Answering statements with yes or no, eh? Signs of physical abuse. Does your government hurt you on purpose? Does your government frighten you? Does your government force you to do things you don't want to do? Does your government sometimes physically hurt you? More good questions. Remember, they're the ones who say relationships shouldn't hurt. Signs of emotional abuse. Does your government make you feel vulnerable? Does your government put you down? Does your government spy on you? Does your government want to control you? Then it's got signs of controlling, or what it calls coercive abuse. Does your government accuse you of doing something wrong? Does your government keep track of you all the time? Does your government tell you how to feel? That might seem a dodgy one, but of course, we know that the syndicated media is part of the whole thing. And when they use anything other than a noun, really, when they use adjectives and stuff, and by their choice of verbs, and actually by the choice of nouns as well, they are obviously quite successfully telling people how to think. Remember the Greek going away of buildings and Paul McCartney, for example. Then it moves on to signs of sexual abuse, which again might seem a little less applicable at first glance. Does your government force you to expose yourself against your will? Does your government force you to do something you don't want to do? Does your government force themselves onto you? And the last one, does your government force you to have sex? Well, of course, we might think, not very often. But then, of course, we remember Simon Spaniard pointing out that commerce is intercourse. And we are, of course, being forced into commerce, are we not? Worth thinking about. Number five, it says signs of financial abuse. Does your government control your finances? Does your government not let you spend your own money? Does your government demand things from you? So that's just a little thing, really. Just well worth thinking about. It just occurred to me as I was reading through the book that, really, those are all bang to rights questions as far as government's concerned, isn't it? And these people, after all, are supposed to be our servants. They're not even our girlfriend, boyfriend or partner. They're our servants. And it's quite clear when you answer those questions how we're being treated, is it not? So, in those circumstances, it doesn't matter whether there is a conspiracy or whether there isn't a conspiracy, or whether we just choose to start using different words to describe what's going on with us, really. Because quite clearly, it seems to me, anyway, that government does do all of those things. Is that really what we're voting for? Is that really what we're paying for? Because that really is what we're voting for and what we're paying for, it seems to me. Well, I suppose it's a bit appropriate now. We'll have another quick tune before I come back briefly before the end of the show. And I think it's only fair at this point that we should play, what do you think, maybe Lover's First Quarrel by the Foghorn String Band, who, of course, were playing at Fire in the Mountain earlier this year. Back with you in 2 or 3 minutes. Ta for being there. Dr. Rock's radio show, raconteursnews.com. Just in case you'd forgotten. And just to make sure that I haven't. In the meantime, we've probably worked our way to the end of another show now. I'm going to have to go and put all of this stuff onto the machine and see, aren't I? Well, one way or the other, I'm going to play out with 3 more tunes. Hopefully, if everything's gone according to plan, we're going to play you Jace Everett to start with and Bad Things. I want to do real bad things with you. Could be the, could be the motto of the world management team, that. That's going to be followed once again by a band from the Harlequin Fair, another track from Flutatious. This one's called Consumption, and it's really grown on me, this one. I've listened to it a few times. Interesting lyric when the lyrics come in, and a great groove, I reckon. And then we're going to finish with a more typical Dr. Rock song, with Lone Star doing Women Rule the World. One way or another, if all goes well, I'll be back with you next week. Thanks to you all for being out there, because I wasn't, and thanks to the people who pick it up on the pod. And to Raconteurs News. Strength to strength, guys. It's really great to be playing with you. We'll see you all next week. Cheers, folks.